Hello, everybody. Welcome into Sports Day Insider, presented by the Dallas Morning News. I am Kevin Sherrington, joined by my pals, Evan Grant and David Moore. I am in New York at the Olympic Summit. That's been interesting so far. David, are you...
What are you learning there?
What am I learning?
Yeah.
I'm learning lots of things, you know, about the Olympics and about those rings and how they put those together, those five rings. It's unbelievable how they did that. I'm going to run
out. Do they have you participate in some of the sports so you get an idea of what it's like? Are you doing like 880 hurdles or something?
No. I was not going to do that, but I am going to do, I think, the synchronized swimming, which is now called artistic swimming.
Oh, nice.
Swimming. I'm going to do that, yeah.
But so Kevin, this is a USOC event, right?
Yeah.
And basically, it is for all of us media types to get acclimated with what will comprise the U.S. team at the Olympics.
Yeah, we only got 18% of the athletes actually named so far. So it's going to be over 800 U.S. athletes. Obviously, they're far short of that. Right at the moment, we have 11 from Texas who have been named. Unfortunately, none of those 11 are here. There is one that has a connection, and she grew up in Wiley. She's a weightlifter. She lives in Atlanta now. But anyway, that's kind of the situation now, just to get an idea.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's great. Right. They keep asking me back in the office, well, Kevin, is there anything else that you can write from this stuff? They wanted me to be tweeting, you know, about it and taking pictures of stuff. And I took a picture of a girl's croissant necklace, a woman. She's Kelsey Bing. She's a goalkeeper from Houston who went to Stanford, and she's a goalkeeper on the field hockey team. But, you know, it's just, I don't know.
Necklace that has a croissant on it?
It is a croissant. It's like a little gold croissant.
Is it baked fresh every day? Does she put a different croissant on the necklace every day?
This is why she's so pumped about going to Paris. You know, it's the home of croissants, you know, so she's really pumped about going to Paris.
Feeding you French food.
You're going to French bistros. That's better than having a souffle on your necklace.
I got to tell you, I had
to eat a bread.
I took a picture of it, and I had to blow it up about 20 times to be able to even tell what it was. It is so tiny. It's like, what was the point?
You know, look, escargot.
Could have been a hot dog. You know, I don't know. Could have been anything. So anyway, that was the deal. That's not been the highlight. There have been some other stuff. There's been some good stuff. It's been interesting. I've seen a few people. You know, this will be my 10th Olympics in Paris, and so I've seen a few people that have been to some of those Olympics, but not, I got to tell you, not too many. The LA Times, I was talking to a young reporter from there, and this is going to be her second Olympics. And she said that originally there were going to be 20 people, 20 riders from the LA Times were going to go until they had layoffs. And now 3 are going.
Wow.
From 20 to 3.
Well, yeah, that's quite the change.
Yeah, that is. It is.
Well, the bad thing is that you're stuck in New York for this, and so you probably don't get a chance to go out and do anything. And
no, I hadn't had a chance to eat really good food.
Backwater town like that.
Yeah, there hasn't been really any good food or anything. There's nothing fun to do here. Golly, you know.
If you do go out, I would suggest taking that credential off your neck if you do go out and walk the streets of New York.
I do take this off because I don't want anybody. Well, although, you know what? In New York, people aren't going to see something weird. I mean, you can't walk 10 feet in New York without seeing something weird.
Kevin, were you up there Sunday night for the 100th Billy Joel concert at Madison Square Garden?
Did you get to see the end of it that the viewing audience did not?
I'm still waiting to find out what happened to Davey. Is he still in the Navy?
Yeah, well, you know, the great thing about that was we were actually in the hotel bar, and of course they don't have the sound up. We can just see Billy singing just like everybody else, and we did not stay till the end either. Neither us nor CBS stayed until the end of Billy Joel's concert, which I guess is going to be now shown on April the 19th. In its entirety by CBS.
They're gonna show it
again, yeah. This is like the, what was that, the Heidi?
The Heidi game.
The Heidi game, yeah. You know, it's the Heidi. How did somebody concert, just decide that? Was somebody just bored? Was it some kind of, you know, Gen Z person who said, who is this Billy Joel guy anyway? Click. I'm sick of this.
It was really amazing. And I think that they cut off like 2 minutes of Piano Man, which I mean, I was disappointed, but I think we can all pretty much sing it by heart. But anyway.
No, that's true. I give Billy all the props in the world. He's what, 75 years old? He's about to be 75, I think, and he's still bringing it. Although I have to say, I was always, you know, of the two piano guys from the 70s, I was always an Elton John guy more than Billy Joel. I loved Elton.
I saw them together 30 years ago. I saw them together when they toured together. And before they, I believe they started to hate each other at that point.
Oh, I hate to hear that. They don't. No,
that's Simon and Garfunkel. You got to mix it up with another.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Yeah, exactly.
It was great. But everybody hates Garfunkel. On the stage at like the Georgia Dome. Yeah.
Yeah, that's too bad. All right, well, we need to start talking about those Rangers, Evan. So the Rangers are well, actually, both of the teams that were in the ALCS last year are struggling. The Astros are struggling for a number of reasons, and as are the Rangers. And I think the fortunate thing for them at this point is, you know, we'll see what the Mariners do. They got to get some of this stuff worked out at some point. We talked all spring about how they should have gotten more depth in the starting pitching, but we thought that the bullpen was pretty good. You know, how much of this rotation problem has affected the bullpen, and how much of it is just the bullpen of its own?
I don't think it's really been, well, let me step back for a second, right? I think Andrew Heaney and John Gray have piled up a lot of pitches, and because of it, they haven't gone deep into games, and that's put some pressure on some middle relievers. But Jose Urania had done a really good job up until the second inning that he worked against Houston the other day. I think that the rotation, by and large, has acquitted itself pretty well. Eovaldi's been great. Cody Bradford has been really, really good.
Until he got hurt.
Yeah, and I he's not walking around like he's really, really stiff. I think he'll be okay. I just think that the bullpen has been, you know, the narrative figures in somewhat, right? I think that the bullpen was such an issue last year. We were all curious to see how the bullpen was going to work out this year. The bullpen had more depth this year. Guys pitched better in spring training. Season starts and a bullpen is still a question mark. And so until that goes away, until they get more games like they did on Monday night when they got, you know, four really sharp innings, from two from Leclerc, one from Robertson, and one from Yates, until they get more like that, it's going to continue to be an issue. I've talked with some Rangers people about this, and I don't know why. Bullpens are fickle organisms. We've talked about this over and over, Kevin, right? But it's almost like spring training doesn't matter for relievers. You know, when the season starts, it's a whole new game, and you don't know what you've really got out there, and it evolves over time. The Astros have had problems with Josh Hader. It's amazing. The one thing that you can do to help your bullpen out is get decent starting pitching. I think the Rangers have, by and large, gotten that. And when they've needed to go to that long reliever, they've gotten decent work out of Jose Urania. It's just hard to try and figure out exactly how to predict the back half of that bullpen.
And so what we see happening now on Thursday is a little, I don't know if this is a positive sign or not. It's a positive sign, I guess, that Jack Leiter could make a start on the big league level at this point, because last year we certainly didn't have any indication that he would be ready to take this kind of leap this early in the season.
Yeah, and last year he they couldn't put him out there and think that they were going to get a competitive start because of the inability to control the strike zone. He has controlled the strike zone much, much better at AAA Round Rock. I think he's got 25 strikeouts in 14 innings. I think only two or three walks. It's been a really good strikeout to walk rate, and that is something that the Rangers really put a lot of weight on, is strikeout to walk rate, the ability to miss bats, the ability to not give up free base runners. I think that there was some, and you and I talked about this a little bit the last week of spring training. I think there was some thought in the Rangers camp as spring training went on that Leiter kind of responded to higher challenges. You know, that this is a guy who grew up in a big league family that maybe, you know, minor league baseball, I don't want to say bored him, but I think was just kind of ready for a big league type challenge. I think he went out, he made three good starts. I think this is going to be a one-off kind of deal. The Rangers just need to get through this 17-game stretch without a day off. And so they wanted to build in a sixth starter here. That's what Leiter's outing will do. And I think it gives Leiter, it'll serve, whatever happens on Thursday, will serve as a good kind of North Star for Jack to say, okay, this is the stuff I've got to do to finish off, to really compete up here. And so I think it's a good learning experience. It's a good opportunity to reward him for making progress. I think it's a good environment in which to place him in. You know, you don't want to have him face Atlanta. You didn't want to have him face Houston. You've got him facing a Detroit team that's young and that is still kind of on the way up. And I just think I think circumstances allow for the opportunity for him to have a competitive start, and it lines up well. So why not? And the other part of it is, you know, there's no other options really.
Yeah, there is. Let me ask you this. Let's say he pitches well, because I'm going to look at this, try to look at it a little more, you know, I don't know, pessimistically. I'm not going to try to expect too much of Jack at this point. But let's say that he does go out there and throws four good innings. Is there a possibility that he sticks and Urania goes down?
I don't think so, because Urania would, you know, they'd potentially lose Urania on a DFA, because they'd have to DFA him. Yeah. I think that there's every possibility that Jack will have a role on this team at some point in time this season. I do think this is more of a one-off type situation than what would develop. I don't think that after three starts, he's ready to compete at the big league level day in and day out. I think it's an opportunity to just kind of get an evaluation, and that's sometimes what you have to do.
Sure. All right, now let me ask you this about, because we didn't talk about it, the fact that Michael Lorenzen made his first start. I'm up here, so I didn't get to see that. What did you see? And he had, what, five walks, which was a little troubling. But other than that, obviously, he held them scoreless. So what did you think?
He managed runners on the base pass really well. You know, one thing Michael had talked to me about after his starts at Round Rock was that the automatic ball strike system is down there, and he couldn't get guys to chase as much because they just take it and take their chances. I don't know if that had an impact on his ability to manage the strike zone on Monday night, but I do think that's something that teams are going to have to look at a little bit, is that their guys who go down to AAA and work with an automatic ball strike system, their ball strike rate may not be quite the same at the minor league level that it gets to at the big league level. And so there may be a little bit of an adjustment period. This was his first start. He had no spring training. I wasn't really expecting much. That he gave them five innings of scoreless baseball is a plus. That there were five walks, not great. But I look at it as a very positive overall first outing for him.
Yeah, no question about that. Well, they needed a fresh arm, you know, frankly, and especially with Cody Bradford out. Let's talk a little bit about Cody, too, because I tell you, the thing that impressed me about him last year was that he, you know, so many of these guys, and you watch Andrew Heaney pitch, and Lord knows, and he talked about this after the game, it's like you're just saying, just throw a freaking strike, you know? And
in spring training one day he talked about an issue of like trying to control his slider, and I was like, man, you're so deep in your head right now. And then on Sunday when he was explaining his outing against the Astros, it was the same kind of thing. That was like, or Saturday I should say, I was like, dude, man, you are making it too hard. You are thinking about a million different thoughts, and you should just be up there trying to throw strikes. And so that's what he'll try and get back to. I do think that Cody Bradford has confidence in his ability to pitch, and that's the number one thing. You know, conviction is where everything starts. He throws strikes. He knows he throws strikes. He's confident that his defense will make plays behind him, and he's not afraid to let them do that. And that's a huge, huge element in becoming a big league pitcher. I like the way Cody Bradford approaches everything. I think he's got the makeup for a big league pitcher. I think he's got the regimen for a big league pitcher. I've never doubted since he's come up. I've never doubted that he was going to be a guy who helped this team. I just thought that in a championship type rotation, Cody was a guy who profiled more as kind of your spot starter, like long relief type guy. This team, I think, is Cody's not an overpowering guy. But if he throws strikes, I think that this is a team. This is a guy who can compete.
Well, this is an interesting case to me because, you know, it's not like this is the first time around the block with him. He did pitch a significant amount of time last year. You would think that teams have the book on him now and they know what he throws and know how. And because when you say he's not even close to overpowering. I mean, he's like 92, right? With a fastball
on a good day, I think. Yeah, 91, 92.
So that's what I'm thinking. Could this guy be another Kyle Hendricks? I mean, is that potential out there for him to be something like that?
You know how I feel about these comps when we talk about a guy who won an ERA title or a Cy Young or anything like that. I get your point. I think that the important thing with Cody is, look, he's using the changeup about 30% of the time now. He's factoring in the curveball about 15% of the time. He's just becoming a more well-rounded pitcher. And, Kevin, I see him at his locker every day taking copious notes. I see him looking at video. These are things that you see. You don't see other guys necessarily doing that out in the open. Cody. Yeah.
He's doing it in the dugout.
What's that?
He's doing it in the dugout.
Yeah. I mean, he's really serious about both the science and the art of pitching. And I think that gives him some degree of an edge in some regard, right? Because a lot of it is not just stuff. Andrew Heaney has good stuff. You know, John Gray has really good stuff. And sometimes they just get so deep in their head that they can't get out of it. Cody, I think, is a guy who trusts his stuff and has a really good game plan when he goes out there. And so he doesn't wobble very much. So the thing that scouts always talk about is makeup. And it's the sixth tool for me, and you can't ever gauge it. And maybe this is a guy with off the charts makeup who's able to maximize his ability in the big leagues.
Well, look, here's the thing. If I were going to identify three pitchers on this staff right now who are guys who seem mentally fragile to me, and maybe that's a little tough to say that, maybe they don't have enough confidence in their stuff. It is the two guys you said, Heaney and Gray, and then the third would be Jose Leclerc. And these are guys to me that I just want to say that it's like Jose Leclerc. It's like, you got such good stuff. Quit trying to hit the corners with it. Just throw it, you know, at one of the quarters of the plate and let the movement do the rest of it for you. You know?
I think with all three of those guys, right, there's some degree of body language issue that we see on TV from the press box. And Leclerc, you see these close-ups of a guy who looks – I don't think he's confused on the mound, but he just looks confused. I think with Leclerc, it's more of a mechanical issue that he's trying to harness his movement a little bit.
He did say that, but, you know, he told Emily Gray and Emily before his last blow up when he was still the closer. Emily Gray on television said, "Hey, I talked to Jose before the game, and he said it's a mental thing with him." And I thought, I can't. First of all, I cannot believe he said that out loud. You know, even if that's the truth, you cannot say that as a closer. You cannot say it's a mental thing for me. And that's what makes me think, you know, I've kind of battled with these, you know, readers who write me and say, oh, he's not tough enough to be a closer and all that kind of stuff. And I always just said, well, the stuff is good enough. I think he can still do it. But when he says stuff like that, it's hard to defend him. You know, I bless his heart. He's being honest. But I just think that once you verbalize that, you have spoken it into being. You know, you have now said, yes, I have a mental aspect about pitching.
I would, and the one thing I would caution there is, again, we're talking about Jose talking in his second language and him conveying that it's a mental issue. I don't know that it has the same kind of connotation that we always take it as. I do think that, look, he is a guy, we can just agree on this, right? He is a guy that gets in his head, in his own head a little bit.
Yes.
I just feel after talking with him, it sounds to me like he had been struggling more with how much his ball had been moving physically, and where you have to start stuff to get it to land in the strike zone or to get realistic chases. Listening to Heaney the other day, it just sounded like a guy who had 8 million thoughts in his head going on at one time. Yeah. That for me, there was a difference there. Like, right. One was, you know, one thought that, or one issue that a guy couldn't really command. The other was, I've got 18 different things going on in my head right now. And John Gray, I don't have an explanation for John Gray. He had a good start the last time out. And as you say, bless his heart too. He's a very sincere guy, wants to work really hard, has good stuff. But there are just days where it's like, John, you know, can we just like attack hitters? And
I really think, to me, the more the situation with John Gray, it reminds me of when I play golf. You know, every once in a while, I'll hit a really nice shot, you know, and then I'll hit 4 or 5 in a row and I'm doing great. And then I just completely lose it. And I have no clue as to what's gone wrong. My oldest son, Jake's a really good golfer, and he'll try to tell me, Dad, you need to do this, you need to do that. And I said, really? I mean, and to me, that's what it surprises me with John Gray. It's like when he's off, when he loses it, it's like he has no idea what's gone wrong here.
Right. He doesn't have the ability to make the adjustment inside the inning and snap back in, minimize damage, right? I think he's more prone to big innings than other guys are. I just have to say this, Kevin. All I know is, we had a putting green because the mansion at spring training was such a gigantic estate. We had a putting green out
beautiful
back.
Place. Beautiful.
And it was, I love the landlord. I hope Wes isn't listening right now, but the putting green is not in great shape, right? There's seams. The pin placements are very tough. And you, all spring, I had been trying to hit one putt downhill across a break. And I couldn't do it. You went out there, you took 4 putts and from like 40 feet away, drained it. So don't tell me that you're a bad golfer. Don't tell me that at all.
The putt stuff is not a problem. All right. Before we get out of this Rangers segment, I do want to talk a little bit about two things real quickly. Give us your little number here, which is pretty interesting on the number of first round draft picks the Rangers have worked into the season already.
Well, so, I mean, you know, with Cole Wynn making his debut on Sunday, that's a 2018 first rounder. Davis Wenzel, who came up to replace Justin Foscue, Wenzel was a supplemental first rounder in 19. Justin Foscue was a 2020 first rounder. Jack Leiters, a 2021 first rounder. Wyatt Langford is a 2023 first rounder. So that's 5 first rounders to make debuts for this team in the span of 3 weeks. That's pretty amazing.
That is, especially given this club's track record with first rounders. Not that many. I mean, you could look, that doesn't mean that Davis Wenzel is going to end up being an everyday player in the big leagues or Cole Wynn either. I think some of these other guys will be, but there was a time there where these first rounders just disappeared. you know, we never saw them again. So at least they are showing an upward trend on first round picks, that they're at least getting some mileage out of them. So give them good for that. All right, let's talk a little bit about the hitting, Evan. You know, they've struggled hitting. This team has pretty much all year. It's had its moments when they look like they did last year. But they have struggled somewhat. And I wonder how much of that, though, when I look at this lineup, it's not the same. You know, when Josh Young's not out there, it's not the same. And so I do think that they've gotten really good mileage at first base from Jerry Walsh and replacing Nathaniel Lowe. That really hasn't been a downturn there. But Corey Seager's power. Go ahead.
I would disagree with you a little bit. At first base, Walsh had a really good start. He struggled a lot lately. He had some really awkward swings on Saturday that were just late, doesn't even begin to describe the swings. Ezekiel Duran, who has played first base against left-handers, has really gotten off to a rough start. So they haven't really gotten a ton of production out of first base. And this all leads to this, right? This is a team that right now is without half of its infield, with Lowe being at the minor league, being in the minors on rehab, and Josh Young obviously out for at least another 8 weeks. Corey Seager is playing pretty much every day, but listen, this is a guy who goes to work rebuilding his swing every day. There's a lot of maintenance involved for Corey on his swing. I think the fact that he didn't have a spring training has probably played a little bit of a factor there. I think he's acquitted himself just fine to start the season, but I think, you know, it's certainly not a World Series MVP version of Corey Seager that we're seeing right now. The rest of the lineup has done okay. Marcus Semien's off to a better April than he's typically off to. Adolis Garcia has been great, but there was a situation last week where against Oakland in one of the losses where they had the bases loaded, nobody out, and, you know, it's perfect time for Adolis to rack up RBIs. He chases two pitches that were way inside, and then he tops a ball that ends up being a pitcher to home to first double play, and it's just the one bad at bat that he's had maybe all year ends up costing them in that game. So it's one of those stretches. I think what I'm getting at is, given all the pitching issues that the Rangers had going into the season in terms of the lack of depth in the starting rotation, given what we've seen from the bullpen this year, and given how much time and what guys are missing from the lineup right now, for them to be, as we tape this before the 12-10 start on Tuesday afternoon, for them to be 9-8 at this point in time and this deep into this 17-game stretch, I think is – I'm not going to say it's mission accomplished, but I think they've more than held their own. There has been some inconsistency, but I think there are reasons for that inconsistency, and I think that this is a team that needed to simply get through the first month of the year, maybe the first 2 months of the year, before they started to get real reinforcements all across the roster. If this team holds its head above water for the first 2 months, it has the possibility of being a really hot team as the summer goes on.
All right, that's going to do it for our Rangers segment of the podcast. We're going to move over now and talk a little bit about the Cowboys. So, David, we've got the Cowboys. We got the draft coming up. They're just now getting into their offseason stuff. CeeDee Lamb is a no-show. Micah Parsons is doing his own thing. Where does this put everything with the Cowboys right now?
Well, it is very interesting when the coaching staff's on one-year deals and you have three major players who are part of this team's future, and Dak Prescott, CeeDee Lamb, and Micah Parsons, who at this point don't have extensions or are not engaged in serious talks at this time to extend. I would say other than Dak, I think they've had some conversations there and kind of have a little bit more of a framework. But, you know, I found it very interesting that when the veterans reported for the voluntary phase, and that should be stressed, voluntary of the off-season program, that Philadelphia, who was starting the same day as Dallas on Monday this week, announced that they had signed Vonta Smith, their receiver, to an extension, the same day that CeeDee Lamb, as we all knew, was not going to show up to make a point about wanting his not wanting to play the fifth-year option on his deal. He wants an extension now before the season starts. So that was just a very stark, yet another stark example of how the Cowboys in Philadelphia go about their business differently. To me, it's even more interesting from the aspect of Vonta Smith has an extension now. He was in the draft class after CeeDee Lamb. And Philadelphia worked ahead and gave him an extension really a year before it needed to be done. Just two very different ways of conducting business.
And that kind of seems like to me, though, this is the way the Cowboys conduct business, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, their argument would be people talk about jumping out of front of the market where you don't have to pay as much. Their counter argument to that would be, okay, if you jump out too early, maybe you're paying beyond what that player is worth. And you have examples of that in Jalen Smith, Lyle Collins, when they did his deal, you know. The other side of it is also if you're, you know, it's great to be ahead of the curve, but then what happens 2 to 3 years later, those contracts are out of whack because those players were ahead of the curve and they want to renegotiate even though they have a couple of years left. And traditionally, the Cowboys don't like to renegotiate deals with players on existing contracts. So you can argue it, you know, either side you want. But the message is the same for a highly frustrated, anxious, and mad Cowboys fan base, which is, why do all these other teams that you're competing against have the financial wherewithal to make moves in the offseason? And you don't even retain your own, and you say you don't make a big splash on the free agent market because you want to pay your own players, yet more of your own free agents left this year than at any other time. And the three main guys you want to sign going forward in CeeDee Lamb, Micah Parsons, and Dak Prescott, there don't appear to be any meaningful or ongoing negotiations at this point. So it's a very, I think anxiety and anger at the Cowboys is the highest that I've ever sensed it from fans this offseason.
So, David, give us an idea of that. You know, how much of this is just the Cowboys kind of screwing this up? And how much of it is that, well, a lot of these things were guys that they really weren't wanting to keep anyway, and they let go, and this is just the kind of cost of doing business. And because, you know, I can look back on the days when I remember when they gave, you know, Moose Johnston a contract, a fullback, you know, gave him a contract at the end of his career. It's like, what in the world are you doing giving this guy another contract? So they progressed from those days when they were giving contracts to everybody to now. Now they're much more selective about it. So in a way, obviously, you do want them to be fiscally responsible about this and make sure that you're giving your contracts to the right people. But then when it comes at the same time that you're coming off one of the most embarrassing playoff losses in the team history, it just looks like, well, it's just one thing after another.
Yeah, this is your response to that. You know, this is a team that's 12-5 in three consecutive seasons, crumble with home field advantage to a young, inexperienced team with many of the principals making their first postseason appearance. And your response is to bleed talent of your own free agents and really only offset it with one outside free agent. And he's a 32-year-old linebacker. And we know what a toll that position takes on players as they get older. So, this just doesn't – to me, more so than any other point, I think a lot of times, you know, people roll their eyes with Jerry and his offseason message. But I never got the sense he was tone deaf. I always felt that he was tapped into the frustration of the fan base and would try to placate them or say some things or acknowledge that frustration this is the first year I can really think of Jerry just being tone deaf. And it's almost like I'm going to explain business, how business works to everybody. And this is how it is. And you have to pay the piper at some point and all this. And, you know, but I think what you've gotten to a little bit is here, is Jerry, look, has the Jones family taken this hardline fiscal stand, and are they superseding principle over building this team in the moment? Look, every team in the NFL, every team in any sport has, the Rangers, we just saw that. You know, they have a time to capitalize right here. And you're going to build on that, or are you going to come up with financial rationalizations on why you can't do that right now? I think Jerry has gotten, as he's gotten older, has gotten into this, you know what? If I do go all in, to borrow one of his phrases this year, it is going to have cap ramifications, and we're going to be a five and 12 team for a year, and then maybe 6 and 11. And I don't want to go, I don't want to bottom out again. I want to always be relevant and always be in the conversation and be close to doing it. But do you put yourself on the treadmill of mediocrity there? And I think there's a sense of Jerry doesn't want to bottom out again. That he feels there's a nucleus here. I don't want to bottom out. Let's trim around the edges. Let's get more from our star players, put the responsibility on them, and let's build it that way. We're right there. Let's go about it this way. But I don't know that a lot of people are buying it right now on the outside of the organization.
No, I don't think so either. You know, I got something from a friend of mine who said that he's had season tickets forever. He got PSLs, you know, and so this year he noticed that the price had gone up 23%.
Wow.
23%. That's got to be a hard sell now, isn't it? I mean, talk about being tone deaf.
Well, it is hard sell. And then, and these are different businesses, and Jerry has, as the Jones family likes to say, has his finger in a lot of pies. There are a lot of different financial pies in the Jones family. A lot of, it truly is a business empire.
A lot of pies ruined, David.
A lot of pie, yeah. But again, he gives $100 million into another aspect of it when they're spending nothing on it. Now, a lot of, you know, you understand logically, well, look, he couldn't use some of that money and put it over here, but he is choosing to spend it in that industry and not his football industry. And so I think fans have a right to look at that and go, and what have we heard for the last decade plus, really closer to 15 years? We don't spend big money in free agency because you overpay. We keep that money back to retain our own free agents because we have a better feel for them. They're part of this culture. They know how it works. We have a better familiarity with them. There's the continuity of the process and how this team is built. They're not doing that this year. They had 18 free agents and only retained three of their own free agents, and one was a long snapper.
Yeah, he was the cheapest one. That's the thing about that David, that's really interesting to me, is to think that in the end, did CeeDee Lamb and Micah Parsons just turn out better than they thought they were going to be? I mean, it feels like, okay, yeah, you want to pay your own, especially when they're really good players. But these guys are at the top of their positions. Certainly Micah Parsons is, and CeeDee Lamb is right up there in the conversation.
Yeah.
And so when you have two players like that and are playing at that level, and those are positions that are getting paid, you know, edge rushers get paid. And yes. And now wide receivers are getting paid.
Receivers' salaries have exploded over the last 3 years.
Yes, they have. And so when you got those two things happening now, it's kind of like, it feels like the Cowboys weren't planning on that. They weren't planning on having to pay these two guys this much so soon.
Well, I don't think they planned on Micah Parsons being remember, they drafted him as a linebacker who was going to be some situational pass rushers. They didn't realize he would be what it appears to be a generational pass rusher,
right.
You know, so that kind of changes the equation there. And I don't think they felt that, you know, the 12th player taken in the draft 3 years ago arguably is the best player in that draft class. Sure. So I think his impact has been greater than what they anticipated. But they were hoping this would be the case for CeeDee Lamb. When they let Amari Cooper go, it was with the understanding that, look, Lamb's going to take over this room. He's going to be the alpha receiver. He's going to get Amari Cooper plus money. We need to clear the decks now so we'll have that money to pay him. And look, it's not just the fact that he's not signed yet, because he has the fifth-year option on this deal. I mean, he is under contract for another year. It's the fact they're not even talking right now. Now, I think both sides have taken extreme stances. I think that, you know, CeeDee Lamb, as we've talked about before in this podcast, I don't think he's jumping out there wanting to necessarily get the deal done right now, because he doesn't want to see Justin Jefferson come back, you know, a week later and top his deal. So I think there is that ego and, you know, hey, getting the best deal in the moment, being the highest paid guy at the position is working. And I think that is tapping the brakes a bit from that end as far as getting something done. But, you know, I think you could argue that the Cowboys are offering the basement of what a deal should be on the other end. So one is at the beyond the ceiling, the other is below the basement. And so they're just not even talking right now. It's really my understanding of where things are.
You guys have been talking for 12 minutes and I'm still just,
oh yeah, the draft's coming up too.
No, the draft is coming up, but I'm just still like stuck and have been stuck for months now on how this doesn't line up with Jerry saying we're all in on 2024.
Oh, I still think that the all-in thing was referring to the fact that everybody's on a 1-year deal. You know, it's like, yeah, let's see how you do, and then we'll decide if you're going to come back or not. I mean, to me, that's what all in meant to me when he said all that. Was that
that's what you've maintained? Yeah,
I just, and who knows what Jerry means about anything that he says? You know, if we're going to hold him to that, we're all going to be in a huge mystery for most of our lives here. But let's doodle, get it.
His doodles make more sense than what he
his
says.
His doodles sometimes make more sense, as David so entertainingly pointed out in his story the other day. That was a very enjoyable, David. All right, let's talk a little bit about the draft before we get out of here. Sure. I know that we're really going to get into it next week.
We'll get more specific handle names next week, you know.
Absolutely. But, you know, our old pal Calvin Watkins has been running his little drafts out there, and he's had some things that come up, and he's talked about some different people. You know, Graham Barton, who played left tackle at Duke, but he
projects as an interior offensive lineman. Yeah,
right.
And they do like him a lot. He was one of their visits. They like him a lot.
Yeah, that sounds kind of like the kind of thing they might do, you know, in that situation. I will say that in one of his mock drafts, Byron Murphy, the defensive tackle from Texas, had fallen to the Cowboys at 24. And I got to tell you, I know that they need an offensive lineman, but if you could get Byron Murphy, who's really good, I think, you know, and I know I've talked about Devondre Sweat and how much I like him, but Byron Murphy is a three-down, you know, defensive lineman, a guy with a tremendous burst, and was really good for Texas this last year. I think I'd have a hard time passing that up.
Oh, I think they would too. That being said, talented, a defensive tackle that's a three-down defensive tackle that's as talented as him, it's hard to envision him dropping down to 24 in today's NFL. You know, you've seen defensive tackles go higher and higher, and especially this is not a particularly deep defensive tackle draft at the top. So I think the other thing to remember is when you have that and there's one defensive tackle you want to take in the first round, teams are going to, you know, look to move to jump in to fill that spot because they know they didn't do it in free agency and they're not going to be able to do it the rest of the draft to their satisfaction. So if he's there, yes, he's a very strong consideration. I have a hard time believing he will be there when the Cowboys are on the clock.
Yeah, me too. But they have my permission to take him if that comes up. So
they would. He would certainly be in the discussion. Now, as much as they want to take and need to take an offensive lineman in the first, if they have a player like that who's available, they wouldn't hesitate in my mind.
Yeah, I don't think they would either. Now, one of the other critiques I had of Calvin's draft was he had in the third round, he had him taking a wide receiver. And I got to tell you, I can't even remember who it was. But at that point, if you haven't taken a running back by the third round, that's a mistake, isn't it?
I think so, the way they're constructed right now. And I really do believe Brooks is a conversation point late in the second round there. Really? Yeah. So, but yeah, I, now again, here's the other thing. The way this draft sets up right now, if they don't take a running back by the third round, they don't have a fourth or fifth round pick until compensatory pick. So what is it, 86 or whatever it is, 88. If they don't take a running back in the first 86 picks where they are, they go 93 picks without a draft pick. Yeah. 93 before they're on the clock again. The running back board's going to be gone by then. Then you just, you take a late guy and you hope he hits and he's beyond what you think. But you can't really bank on that, and Pencilman is your rotation, right? You're just hoping to make it work. So I feel where they are now, they do have to take a running back in the second day of the draft. The only way they wouldn't is if with that first round pick or second round pick, they move back and pick up something in the third or fourth. And, you know, let's go back to that Micah Parsons draft. They were at number 10, but Philadelphia was at 12, knew they had to get ahead of the Giants at 11 to take Smith, the receiver we were talking about earlier. So Dallas moved back two spots, got Parsons, who they would have taken at 10 anyway, and got an additional pick in the third round, who they turned into Chauncey Golston. But again, the whole point is just moving back two spots. Now, they were higher in the first round. That's more of a premium. But moving back a couple of spots in the first round, they did that. I'll go back to the Travis Frederick draft. No one was excited about that Travis Frederick pick, but they moved back to at the end of the first round and acquired a third-round pick that they turned into a Terrence Williams, who was a very good receiver for them for a while.
Yeah, he was. All right, that's going to do it for the Cowboys segment of our podcast. We're going to move over now and talk about a little potpourri here. We had Scottie Scheffler won his second Masters over the weekend. I got to tell you, he is an interesting story to me from a number of angles. One that, you know, of course, Jordan Spieth, and, you know, he is linked with him and Will Zalatoris. You know, they were all – Will and Scottie were friends. Jordan was more of an older guy, a little older than him. And they looked up to him, but they all did play together. And Jordan certainly had a great run, and now he has struggled since. And who knows if he's going to be able to get that all back together. But Scotty looks as good as Jordan did in his prime at this point. Every time he goes out, he's got a chance to win. And you know, when you're getting compared to Tiger Woods, which, you know, he's got a long ways to go to beat Tiger Woods. But when you're getting talked about in those conversations, that's just pretty unbelievable that the Dallas has produced this quality of golfers here in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and he was so dominant in this Masters, right? Difficult weather conditions late, but I mean, again, and he's doing this as the number one player in golf, and you don't see that a lot either, you know.
No,
Rory's still looking for his first, you know, Matt.
Well, absolutely. This is the same, you know, the guys coming back from LIV, you know, Live Golf, and those guys weren't, you know, Bryson DeChambeau had his moments, but he struggled and wasn't able to do anything. And, you know, I just still have the it's just funny for me to watch Scotty, you know, take a shot anyway. It's like a friend of mine, Tom Turbeville, used to be the sports information director down at Texas A&M, tweeted the other day, you know, I was always told that you had to have your feet set when you play golf, you know, and Scotty's dancing all over the place when he's taking shots. Just unbelievable he's able to do what he does in that style, but he's a tremendous ball striker. And then when he gets his putter going, he's practically unbeatable. So congratulations,
somebody
Scotty.
Somebody did a video of that the other day of people trying to replicate Scottie Scheffler's footwork on the driving range, and it was pretty amazing.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. But that's good. I like to see that. He's the Fred Astaire of golfers.
Plus he comes back and celebrates at the Inwood Tavern. I mean, how many guys would do that?
How many guys went straight to the Inwood Tavern with his green jacket still on?
Yes, yes.
How great was that? You know what that kind of hit that was over there. has he had the baby yet? You know, his wife was pregnant.
You know, it's interesting because again, that story came out. It's like Saturday in the press conference, from what I read, it was like, oh, well, he's already made contingency plans if she goes into labor. It's like, she's really not due for about 2 weeks is what I heard, which is the other thing. If you had to get back so quickly, why were you at the Inwood Tavern?
Yeah.
She's maybe he would just blow that up.
Maybe that'd be a little different take on how charming that was, if that was the case.
That's right. So, I think we should rip him for that, don't you?
Yeah. So your wife's in the hospital pregnant. You're down there getting sloshed at the Inwood Tavern. Come on.
So I think she's real. I think the due date is about 10 days away. From
okay. Well, that was good. It was good to know, though, that he was willing to sacrifice all that, or the Inwood Tavern, either one he had to sacrifice, he was willing to do if the baby came out.
Was the Time Out Tavern not open?
You know, those are right next to each other over there.
I know. I'm more of a Tot guy than an Inwood Tavern guy.
Yeah, I was neither, but my kids do like both of those places. They've hung out at those. So I
maybe did the pub crawl. We just got the photos from the others.
Yeah, maybe that's what happened. He would just go from one to the next. Exactly. So David, let's talk a little bit about the Mavericks and where they're positioning themselves at the moment. I got to tell you, David, I'm going to say anything less than the conference finals is going to be a disappointment for this team. Don't you?
Well, going out in the first round would certainly be a disappointment.
Oh, my gosh. But
this is a Clippers team that has knocked them out in the first round and it still has some very good talent. But to really build on what they did, they need to get past the first round. I think the Oklahoma series would be very difficult for them. But I think they have shown they match up pretty well since the trade with that team too. Before the trade, no shot against Oklahoma City.
Probably before the trade, no shot
against the Clippers either. To be frank,
yeah, that really has been a difference maker against the Thunder. They just can't. They really seem to have the Mavericks seem to have the Thunder's number since.
Yeah, it's a good matchup for them. So no, I agree. I think there should be. I think there is a hope / expectation among their fan base, certainly that, this is be like a couple of years ago. Well, they'll get back to the final conference finals. Now, whether they're ready to match up against, I would assume Denver, I doubt that Minnesota would get there, but it's a possibility. How they match up with Denver in that situation, I think it'd be much like them matching up against Golden State when they win. It's going to be very difficult for them, but that's how teams get better. And this is a team that's only been together for a couple of months, and to reach that stage, knowing you can run it back next year with that same nucleus, they did a very poor job coming out of their first unexpected trip to the Western Conference Finals. Of building on that, this appears to be a team that would allow them to build on that the way it's constructed right now and the salaries and the contracts, how they're staggered.
Yeah, it does. And the thing that surprises me about all this, David, and I intend to ask this question, is that, you know, we've been told for years now that centers like Daniel Gafford are extinct, you know, You can't win with these kind of guys. If they can't go out and make an occasional three, oh, they're no good. You can't have them. And so they go out and they give up a first-round draft pick for Daniel Gafford. The Mavericks were panned. The trade was panned by a lot of pundits because of that. And he comes in and they start him right away, and then he was great. And then they sat him on the bench, and he basically disappeared. And then they went to that little tailspin, and they put him in the starting lineup again. And then they started winning. They haven't looked back.
Lively, a rookie who's very valuable as part of your second team, which makes your second team all that.
Oh, absolutely. So now they had it. Now Lively has a higher ceiling than Gafford does. And I think that, you know, that we'll see how that all ends up playing out in the long run. But for now, I think that what this shows to me is that you had to get, you know, they've talked about getting the right pieces around Luka all along.
Yeah.
And we've always wanted, you know, they needed to be more athletic, and they needed shooters, and then they needed to be more athletic, and then they needed to be longer. Well, they have gotten all those things. Wouldn't say that they've gotten the better shooters now. They're still searching for that. That's still been an issue. Tim Hardaway has not responded well. You know, PJ Washington is a nice player, and he can defend a lot of positions.
But Exum's responded in big moments, right? Exum gives you a guy in big moments with Irving and Doncic where you go, okay, we can make this work now. And I think that's a big part of why it's working. And just the threat of Exum, and he's shown he can do it late in games. So now defenses in the postseason are going to have to account for that, which should give Irving and Doncic a little bit more room. And here's the other thing. Look, Doncic carried them to the conference finals a couple of years ago. That's what great players do. Discussion about this being an MVP season for him, you see that in the postseason. Let's see how he performs. He's performed very well in the postseason before. I would anticipate he'll do it again. But that's the thing. Even in a close series, a player of his caliber can take it over and tip the scale if he's playing at the highest level. And so he does give Dallas that shot. Just keep it close. Turn it over to Doncic.
You know, he's going to make his MVP case for next year in these playoffs.
Exactly.
He's not going to win it this year, but he's going to make his case that if they get deep, if they get to the Western Conference Finals, and if they get past that, then yes, then people will say, okay, now it's Luka's time. And if he puts up the kind of numbers he did this year, people won't make the same complaints about him that they've made in the past. All right, that's going to do it for our podcast this week. We thank you for listening in. We've had a great time. We hope that you did too. Be sure to check back with us next week. We'll have our mock draft. It'll be great. We're going to get really deep down into all of that and what the Cowboys are going to do. So from everybody in here to everybody out there, thanks, and we'll see you next time. Now, how much...